Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and we're recording this at 13 hours GMT on Monday, the 19th of August. Our main stories: Sudan's ousted President Omar al-Bashir has appeared in a cage in court on the first day of his trial for corruption. Turkey has condemned an air attack on a convoy it says was reinforcing one of its observation posts in Syria. And Prince Andrew says any suggestion he exploited young girls with the disgraced billionaire Jeffrey Epstein is abhorrent. Also in this podcast, the Canary Islands struggle to tackle a huge wildfire.
It's a constant gripe that the authorities have here in the Canary Islands with the mainland authorities. We want to have at least one water plane, one fire plane. It could be that this fire might change their minds.
And
so we get a compiler list of 60 jokes, basically, and then we run a survey with the Great British public. So 2,000 members of the Great British public get to vote on what they think is their favourite joke.
So what was the funniest gag at the Edinburgh Festival? This time last year, it would have been unthinkable. The man who ruled Sudan with an iron fist for 3 decades appearing in court as a criminal suspect. Omar al-Bashir was forced out in April by street demonstrations. Now, just 2 days after a power-sharing deal was signed between the protest leaders and the army, the former president has appeared in court in the capital Khartoum on corruption charges. One investigator told the hearing Mr. Bashir had admitted receiving $90 million in cash from Saudi Arabia's crown prince. Our correspondent, Sally Nabil, was at the court. I asked her how big a moment this was for the people of Sudan.
According to all the people I've been talking to, they told me that seeing Bashir in the dock has been a dream. They have always thought it can never happen. So for them, this is a dream coming true. But they are concerned whether or not this man is going to have a fair trial. First of all, many people say that he should be accused of far more serious crimes, not just corruption charges. They hold him responsible for all the human rights violations that took place in Sudan over the past 3 decades. They refer specifically to what happened in the western region of Darfur, where a 6-year conflict between 2003 and 2009 resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths and displacing millions of people. So they say that this man should be accused of genocide, of ethnic cleansing, and much more serious crimes than just corruption charges. And secondly, they say that the judiciary at the moment is made up of people who have been appointed by Bashir himself. This is why they are kind of worried about how fair his trial would be.
And what has happened in court so far today?
He arrived and left the court in heavily secured convoys. We could barely see him. Cameras could barely film him. And we have seen a heated discussion between lawyers in front of court, those who support him and those who are against him. Those who support him say the charges are politicized, and those who are against him say that his charge list should be much longer and should include much bigger accusations.
But the court did hear testimony that he had apparently taken a huge sum of money from a Saudi prince.
Yeah, but we have to say that cameras were not allowed inside court. And what we heard from lawyers is that it was just a merely procedural thing. And they even see this money thing as a politicized charge. And they say that he spent the money just in the favor of this country. He got nothing in his pocket. So they say that the charges are basically, they are based.
Sally Nabil at the court in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum. Idlib province in northwestern Syria is the last major stronghold of rebels fighting Syrian government and Russian forces. Turkey, which backs some groups there, agreed a deal with Russia last year to end the fighting. However, Turkey and Syria are now trading accusations over a Turkish military convoy in the area that was hit by airstrikes. The Turkish authorities strongly condemned the attack, while Syria accused them of sending supplies to help insurgents in the embattled town of Khan Sheikhoun. We'll hear more about that dispute in a moment. First, to some of the millions of people caught up in the four-month offensive by pro-government forces. The BBC's Mike Thompson has been speaking to people in Idlib.
When my children hear the war blame, they start crying.
Mohammed Al-Juma lives with his wife and five children in the southern Idlib countryside.
People are afraid of going to the market. They are afraid of bombing by Russian warplanes. They are afraid of explosive barrels. Life is paralyzed completely.
Have you thought of leaving your home, of trying to get away from all the bombing?
Life in tents near Turkish borders is unbearable. We prefer to die under bombing than to leave our home.
More than 350,000 people accumulated in a small area near the Turkey border.
As a medical doctor, Mohammed Abrash is able to pass through the Turkish border to the north of Idlib, something that many ever more desperate Syrian civilians simply can't do.
Turkey has this wall, it's a very high wall, more than 7 meters, and all people try to jump this wall and go to Turkey. And Turkish police is not allowing anyone to go inside.
Dr. Abrash, who works at a hospital in Idlib city, says some medical provisions do get through the border, but his supply is dwindling fast.
Daily it's decreasing, and even the equipment we cannot maintain because we don't have spare parts, and we cannot cope with all this number of patients.
How difficult is life at the moment, not just for medical reasons, but for being bombed for so long? How are people coping?
Every maybe 2 weeks we can find one man, he is trying to suicide. Last week I saw one man, he put the gun on his chest and shot himself. Last time also one girl, 18 years, she jumped from the building and she died.
With bombs continuing to fall on Idlib and all escape routes shut, Mohammed Al-Juma has this plea.
I hope my voice will be heard by the Western leaders. We appeal the world's consciences to stop bombing, to save our children, to save innocent people. Please.
Residents of Idlib talking to our correspondent Mike Thompson. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher told me more about the dispute between Turkey and Syria over the airstrike on the military convoy in Idlib.
The Turks say that they were sending, this is a large convoy, several tanks in it, munitions. They hold 12 observation posts in Idlib, which is part of a deal they did with Russia in order to forestall a major offensive last year by the Syrian government against the rebels there and the jihadists. That hasn't really worked out. You talked about the 4 months of attacks that there've been. That's been intensifying. And there's this town you mentioned as well, Han Shehun, which has become the focus of the attack at the moment. Now, this observation post that the convoy was heading towards is close to Han Shehun, and the Turks essentially are saying that their forces there could have been isolated, could have been in big trouble if the government forces backed by their allies on the ground and Russia in the air had broken through. So what happened essentially was it crossed the border and there were airstrikes on or near the convoy. Now, the Turks have issued a statement saying that 3 civilians were killed, 12 were wounded in this attack, and essentially saying that Russia has responsibility over this, that it is breaking the agreements that Turkey has made with Russia in order to protect this area and the cooperation between the two countries. There are F-16s from Turkey now in the air, which are supposed to accompany this convoy, which as far as we know at the moment is stalled. It's not moving. It's still in Syria. It hasn't moved back. But whether it continues is an open question at the moment.
Because the Syrians were accusing the Turks of an act of aggression, saying that this convoy was actually to help the rebels in Han Shehun.
Yes, which to some extent has truth to it. There's quite a range of rebel groups and jihadists in Idlib. Many of them are supported by Turkey. That's why Turkey and Russia have been the ones who've been doing these deals, because they represent both sides. So there's certainly an element of truth in that.
Sebastian Usher. Prince Andrew, Queen Elizabeth's son, has been forced to distance himself from the billionaire paedophile Jeffrey Epstein. The British royal was a friend of the disgraced American financier who killed himself in jail earlier this month. A video has emerged showing Prince Andrew inside the billionaire's home in New York 2 years after Epstein was jailed for soliciting a teenage girl for prostitution. I heard more about how Prince Andrew has become embroiled in the scandal again from our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Well, you say drawn into it again. It's again and again is the real problem. And this was the latest sort of iteration of his appearances with Jeffrey Epstein, his relationship. And the palace, Buckingham Palace, clearly felt it needed to make some kind of statement as this video emerged of the prince in Jeffrey Epstein's house in Manhattan, New York, in 2010, after he'd been convicted, after Mr. Epstein had been convicted of child sexual offences. So the statement from the palace said the Duke of York has been appalled by the recent reports of Jeffrey Epstein's alleged crimes. His Royal Highness deplores the exploitation of any human being, and the suggestion that he would condone, participate in, or encourage any such behaviour is abhorrent.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a look at the video. You see, catch a glimpse of Prince Andrew waving as a woman leaves, and then he sort of glances around. How damaging is this for the prince and the royal family?
Well, we knew that Prince Andrew had maintained his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein after Mr. Epstein had been convicted of child sex offences in 2008. We know that they were seen walking in Central Park in Manhattan in 2010. We didn't know that Prince Andrew had either stayed or at least visited the house that Mr. Epstein had in Manhattan, a rather large townhouse in Manhattan. And it is a reminder that the royal family really didn't need, of what is clearly a terrible lapse of judgment, what is acknowledged to be a lapse of judgment by Prince Andrew in maintaining a friendship with a convicted paedophile. And that's why we've had this statement, another attempt to draw a line. However, we either expect or we think there may be more information coming out about the relationship, more allegations about Prince Andrew as court papers are opened up and further allegations are made about Mr. Epstein's behaviour by those who allege that he sexually abused them.
Johnny Diamond, our royal correspondent. Singapore's Prime Minister says the island state may need to spend more than $70 billion over the next century to protect itself from rising sea levels. Lee Hsien Loong has outlined an ambitious plan for the city, including the prospect of reclaiming land from nearby islands. This report from Henry Bellow.
Like many low-lying cities, Singapore is vulnerable to rising sea levels and is bracing itself for impact. Close to 30% of the island is less than 5 metres above sea level, and scientists believe that puts property, people and major infrastructure at risk. Some preventative action has already been taken, like expanding Changi Airport to higher ground. But Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong has now outlined a much broader, long-term and expensive plan, arguing action cannot be delayed.
Singapore is already feeling the impact. Our weather is palpably hotter, rainstorms are heavier, and this will very likely worsen over the next few decades, within the lifetimes of many of us.
For a start, the Prime Minister wants Singapore to adopt water management strategies made famous by the Dutch, like building large seawalls and then draining the water behind them to reclaim land. He wants Singaporeans to prepare for the future and realise that many schools, hospitals and trains currently run through low-lying coastal areas.
We can't lose a big chunk of our city and expect the rest of Singapore to carry on as usual.
Singapore is not the only urban centre to grapple with rising sea levels. Venice, Miami and also many Pacific Island nations have taken action, but few have entertained the prospect of a 100-year mitigation plan, including ambitious engineering prospects that would not only protect infrastructure, but transform it.
We could reclaim a series of islands offshore, from Marina East all the way to Changi. Then we join up the islands, connect them with barrages, create a freshwater reservoir.
For now, these bold ideas lack any formal planning, but represent a city preparing for future generations and climate change.
Henry Bellow reporting. Now, before we move on, a quick note about a new music podcast from the BBC World Service. Music Life brings together a group of musicians to talk about the creative process, how to turn an idea into a song, when a piece of music is finished, and what it feels like once it's been released. Search for BBC Music Life wherever you get your podcasts. Mangroves are an important nesting site for hundreds of bird species. They also provide breeding grounds for fish, shrimp and oysters. They're also crucial in the fight against climate change. But around the world, mangroves are disappearing thanks to drought and human activity. For the past 10 years, one of the world's largest mangrove reforestation projects has been quietly restoring mangroves in southern Senegal, as Louise de Wast reports.
In a stretch of land between the Gambia and Guinea-Bissau, the Casamance River runs westward, flanked by corridors of luscious green mangroves. But it wasn't always like this here.
We're getting on a boat now and heading deep into the mangroves with environmentalist Aidar El Ali. He's going to show us some of the reforestation that they've been working on here.
Look, here we have a leaf that exhales salt. And you see, this is salt taken from the water. These trees regulate the level of salinization in the delta. And because the rice fields are nearby, if the mangrove is healthy and regulates this environment, then the fields are fertile. But if the mangroves disappear, the level of salt increases and the rice fields die.
Ali is at the head of an NGO called Oceanium. Much of the reforestation here has been funded by a carbon finance initiative, multinational companies who hope to make money from capturing thousands of tons of CO2. But Ali, previously Senegal's Minister for the Environment, is passionate about reforestation. He's already replanted a surface larger than Paris.
I think we have a lot to catch up on. If we had started in the 80s, today we would have replanted thousands and thousands of trees. We have planted 15,000 hectares or 150 million propagules in more than 400 villages. So we've done a lot, but it is not enough. We need to do more and more and more.
Because of their unique way of regulating saltwater levels, mangroves are crucial for agriculture and fishing. Just outside the main city of Zingishore, we meet Yaya Diata, a farmer. There are new rice fields next to replanted mangroves, and Diata is hoping to produce rice here for the first time.
Reforestation has worked, even on a social level. I am respected by my community because of the work we've done. It's helped local populations. It's going to help future generations.
But about 30 minutes away in Siginar, things are very different. Replantation efforts have failed here, and young people from the village, like Landry Djedou, are left with little to eat and little to do.
In front of us here, all of that, it used to be rice fields. Our parents used to farm here and there was a lot of rice. But now the water is full of salt and we haven't been able to stop that.
A quarter of the total estimated surface area of mangroves in Senegal have been lost since the 70s. Reasons for the degradation are multiple: drought, roads being built, overfishing and illegal logging. Jacob Colley is the local representative of the government agency that's responsible for protected marine areas.
Our main goal is to safeguard the fish stock and try and prevent people from fishing recklessly. From the main road, you can't see, but when you go inside the mangroves, it's a disaster over there. I call it a genocide.
Colley says that his agency has plans to replant trees themselves, 500 hectares over the next 5 years, but he's not sure it will be enough to protect these precious forests for future generations.
Louise de Wast reporting. 8,000 people have been forced to leave their homes on the Spanish island of Gran Canaria because of a wildfire which the emergency services say is proving impossible to contain. It started on Saturday and has spread over an area of more than 35 square kilometres. Gran Canaria, along with Lanzarote and Tenerife, are part of the Canary Islands, which attract millions of tourists at this time of year. The journalist Cleo O'Flynn lives on the Canary Islands. I asked her why the fire was proving so hard to tackle.
The first one is winds. So there have been high winds over the last few days, and they're expecting that to continue until the end of today. The head of the security team, a guy called Federico Grillo, said at a press conference last night that they don't expect to be able to control the weather conditions until late tonight. It's also extremely hot. We're going through a heat wave here in the Canary Islands. So physically, for the firefighters to actually work under these conditions is extremely hard. 400 people worked through the night last night, through Sunday night, to try and at least control the spread of the fire. He said that at the moment what you have are kind of like cones of ash that can go up to a kilometre up into the air, and they have no idea which way they're going to fall. So they can fall to either side, and that just sparks further fires. And in fact, the fire has now entered the UNESCO Biosphere Park of Tamalaba. Now, they're calling that an environmental catastrophe.
Yeah, it is a tourist destination because of the generally nice weather there. Indeed. So it's often hot. I mean, are the authorities prepared for this kind of thing?
Forest fires are something that are always in the minds of the authorities come this time of the year. I mean, in fact, there has been a fire here on Tenerife this weekend and another one in Lanzarote. So forest fires and island fires are part of life here. They are prepared up to an extent. For instance, 800,000 litres of water have been splashed over the fires since Saturday when it began. We have 8 helicopters here, but what we don't have are the large water planes, and they need to be flown down from the Spanish mainland every time there is a forest fire. That's up to a four-hour journey. It's a constant gripe that the authorities have here in the Canary Islands with the mainland authorities. We want to have at least one water plane, one fire plane. It could be that this fire might change their minds. Both the Spanish King and the Spanish Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, were in touch with the President of the Canary Islands, Victor Ángel Torres, over the weekend, offering support, condolences, and inquiring as to how the fires were going. But I suppose, as in any circumstance, when you have a disaster, what people need are practical measures as well as words of support. So maybe now we can get a water plane here in the Canary Islands.
And do we know what started it?
No, that's under investigation at the moment. I mean, there was a forest fire here a week ago, and that was believed to have been started by a man who was welding up near the fire zone. He was questioned, he has been released, but he could be facing a very large fine, thousands of euros.
And that was Cleo O'Flynn talking to me from the Canary Islands. One way to reduce food waste is to make use of the leftovers, and even better if the resulting product can be sold. Well, a small firm on England's northwest coast is doing just that, turning offcuts from a salmon processing factory into crisps. Kaz Graham went to the town of Merryport to see the transformation.
So this department here is our goods in. We bring in 60 tonne of whole salmon per week, the whole salmon with the head on and gutted.
Luke Maloney is operations manager at Grant's. They've been smoking Scottish salmon here, selling to a world market since the mid-1980s.
We remove the salmon's head, we remove the salmon's frame, and we create salmon fillets.
But there's one part of the fish they haven't been using, until now.
You put the fish on the belt, tail first, through the skinner, laid flat and placed in the tub.
It's very thin and shiny. Yes, it's been smoked, so it's cured. It's cured skin. The amazing part is that we've been throwing these in the bin for 30 years, so it's excellent to see a solution to this.
That solution has come through working with Dan Pawson, who's using the skins to make sea chips, a crunchy, savoury snack.
The idea actually came from when I was a private chef and I was cooking for athletes and celebrities such as Kylie Minogue, and they're always looking for the next big kind of healthy snack. And what we found was that we were throwing away loads of salmon skin when we baked it. So instead we started to crisp it up and garnish dishes with it. And all my clients and customers used to love them. So sea chips was born.
Here we have these salmon skins. They're now being laid out. We then take them over to our cooker. You can actually hear them now crackling as it hits with the 180 degree heat. As you can see, they're golden brown, lovely, thin, crispy, totally descaled. There's nothing yucky about them.
You can't get away from the fact, though, that this is fish skin. That is the thing that most of us push to the side of our plates going, I'm not so sure about that. How can you persuade people to buy snacks that are essentially fish skin?
Well, I think there's a couple of ways. One of them is definitely going down the kind of ethical road. You know, we're reducing masses and masses of seafood waste by making these crisps. And not only that,
super high in protein, in fact, one of the highest protein snacks on the market, packed full of omega-3, so great for brain function. Some people do love it, some people hate it, but if we get one out of every 3-4 people like them, kind of, we're happy with that.
Well, they say the proof of the pudding is in the eating, so I've come onto Senhouse Street in Maryport to see what people think of them.
Mmm.
I think he likes them.
Mmm. They're a cross between a pork scratching texture and one of the bacon sizzler type snacks that you get.
They're quite nice, yeah.
They're made from salmon skin.
Salmon skin?
Salmon skin.
I don't like salmon skin.
Well, you've just said you like it.
Kaz Graham reporting. Now, how about a joke to end the podcast? Someone stole my antidepressants. Whoever they are, I hope they're happy. Well, that was ranked as the second funniest gag at this year's Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland. Richard Hamilton has this report on the winner.
OK, drum roll. I keep randomly shouting out broccoli and cauliflower. I think I may have florets.
Olaf Falafel telling his award-winning vegetable-based joke. Falafel, not his real name, describes himself as Sweden's 8th funniest man. His website adds that he's a comedian, illustrator, author, and idiot. He's also made online videos featuring, among other things, a croissant-coiffured Donald Trump puppet, slices of truth-telling cheese being thrown onto newspapers, and the pop group the Bee Gees, famed for their tight trousers, hiding in his beard.
I think a lot of comedy is very subjective and you shouldn't be scoring one joke as funny than the other, although mine is obviously the funniest. It's all definitely about finding your audience, and people who want political satire and very serious stuff shouldn't come to my show, because there's things in there like, talking of cheese, I do a thing where I can kind of predict a little bit about your personality from your favourite cheese. There is a bit about Brexit, but it's about Brexit jiffy bags, because obviously, as we all know, the price of jiffy bags has skyrocketed due to imports from Latvia and Estonia and tariffs and all that kind of thing. I come on stage in a space pod, which is actually a child's IKEA wardrobe.
This year's top 10 one-liners were chosen by a combination of experts and the wider public, who were not told the names of the actual comedians. Luke Hales is the director of the TV channel Dave, which sponsors the Edinburgh Fringe.
We engage with 10 comedy experts, as they're known, so editors of comedy magazines or websites, comedy critics. They're at the Fringe Festival anyway, going to all the shows. During that time, the couple of weeks they're up here, we ask them to narrow down from all the shows they've seen their 6 favourite witty one-liners. So we're not talking about the whole set, we're just talking about the one-line jokes. So they send their 6 in, so we get a compiler list of 60 jokes, basically. And then we run a survey with the Great British public. So 2,000 members of the Great British public get to vote on what they think is their favourite joke.
And to give you a sample of the top 10, the 5th funniest joke was by Ross Smith. A thesaurus is great, he said. There's no other word for it. And fellow British comedian Mark Simmons came in at number 9 with, to be or not to be a horse rider, that is equestrian.
And how about one more? A cowboy asked me if I could help him round up 18 cows... I said, yes, of course, that's 20 cows. That report by Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on the podcast or anything in it, send an email to globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.